In the AMI letters I'm making public, you will see the precise details of their extortionate proposal. They will publish the personal photos unless Gavin DeBecker and I make the specific false public statement to the press that we, quote, have no knowledge or basis for suggesting that AMI's coverage was politically motivated or influenced by political forces, end quote. If we do not agree to affirmatively publicize that specific lie, they say they'll publish the photos, and quickly.
A reading from a Medium blog post written by Jeff Bezos. In it, the head of Amazon accused American Media Incorporated, which owns the National Enquirer, of extortion and blackmail. He says AMI threatened to publish nude pictures he'd sent his girlfriend unless he called off his investigation into how AMI obtained private text messages from her earlier. Well, AMI says its board of directors is now looking into Bezos' accusation of extortion. But the story is a lot bigger than the world's richest man taking on a tawdry tabloid over its threats to publish his below-the-belt selfies. Other threats here include the Saudi government, the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi, and the special counsel's investigation into President Trump. Well, joining us to talk about all of this is David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent and co-host of the show On Point. Hi there, David.
Hey, Madeline.
And also joining us, our legal Loyola Law School professor, Jessica Levinson. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
David, remind us how this all began. So AMI exposed the fact that Bezos was having this affair while he was married. And then Bezos launches this investigation into AMI because what? He thinks that they got this information in some unscrupulous manner?
There was initially, reportedly, the belief that somehow these photos had been perhaps gotten off the electronic devices of Mr. Bezos's girlfriend. Lauren Sanchez's brother apparently is close with Roger Stone, the Trump associate. Carter Page also had been a kind of advisor to the Trump and the Trump campaign and had seemingly trafficked in circles that involved the National Enquirer. There were questions whether somehow Lauren Sanchez's brother had been the weak link, and then it appears that there had been another twist. Mr. Bezos posted an essay to the platform Medium explaining that there was some suspicion that perhaps there were foreign actors involved in this.
Yeah.
And the plot, you know, suddenly, as I said to an editor, and he stole my line for this morning on NPR, it starts to look a lot like a John Grisham thriller.
No, I was thinking the entire Medium post could be a book. I mean, just that.
Yeah, but it's only the kind of book that's sold at airports.
Well, or talked about on the show.
Yeah.
So Lauren Sanchez is the girlfriend. Mark Sanchez is the brother. Mark is the one who's tight with Roger Stone and Carter Page. He lives here in West Hollywood, apparently. And so the thought is that perhaps he got his hands on these communications between his sister and Jeff Bezos?
That was the initial suspicion. I mean, certainly Bezos is now suggesting that the people who are doing this investigation for him are wondering whether somehow there are foreign actors in play. That is, he refers to, for example, the Saudis, obviously a key component of President Trump's foreign policy, but also a source of possible capital to help prop up AMI's at times struggling finances.
Mm.
So it seems as though Bezos is suggesting somehow that even as they promised to cooperate with federal prosecutors in their investigation of Trump World, somehow possibly doing this to further the president's interests, given Bezos owns the Washington Post, which has been very tough on the president.
Right. And then, of course, Jamal Khashoggi worked for the Washington Post. So is he saying that the Saudis hacked his communications? Or is that the implication?
The implication it sort of hangs out there. We don't know. I mean, you're seeing right now a lot of people try to figure out whether or not there are actors in the Trump world involved in this, whether there might be foreign actors, whether there might be foreign security folks involved, or whether perhaps federal authorities somehow got involved at the behest of the White House. Again, this wildly speculative,
yeah.
And Bezos didn't spell it out. But he's leaving it there tantalizing for people to obsess about in the hours after his post.
But what he did do was publish these emails, these private emails that a lawyer for AMI sent, basically saying, call off your investigation or we will publish these salacious photos. You know, some of them are these so-called, which he called the below-the-belt selfies. Jessica, is that illegal to threaten to do that?
It may very well be. So if you look in the dictionary under extortion and blackmail, I mean, there aren't actually pictures of below-the-belt selfies, but that's exactly what the textbooks are talking about. I mean, what you're worried about is somebody threatening to injure somebody else's reputation. That would be Jeff Bezos, in exchange for a thing of value. And in this case, that thing of value looks like promise that you'll say that the National Enquirer and American media is not politically motivated, that none of this essentially is driven to support President Trump. And so we should always wait for additional facts. We should make sure that these emails are authenticated. But this certainly is what we're talking about in terms of this level of extreme pressure of you better do this or I'm going to harm your reputation. That's what we're talking about when we talk about federal extortion and blackmail.
So even if no action is taken, it would still the threat in and of itself could be deemed illegal.
Exactly. It's the threat. It's the intent to injure. You don't actually have to go through with it.
So do you think that maybe AMI should have just published them anyway? I mean, just from a covering their bases legally, if they had published these photos before sending those photos, before sending that email.
Yeah, so assuming that step one, which is the news gathering, was lawful, then we ask step two, can you publish that? Can you disseminate the information? Step two is where the First Amendment comes in with much more force. And this is where courts, frankly, are much more worried about censoring anyone, whether or not we think it's a salacious tabloid or whether we think it's the New York Times or the Washington Post or NPR. And at that point, the press really has broad latitude to publish. If you're talking about somebody like Jeff Bezos, who is a public figure, then there absolutely could be an argument that essentially anything he does is newsworthy, and therefore they had a First Amendment right to publish it.
Right. Okay. But AMI has entered into this immunity deal with the DOJ. This is part of the Mueller investigation and this whole other thing about violating campaign finance laws by doing that sort of catch and kill policy, paying off these two women who claimed they'd had affairs with Donald Trump and not publishing stories about that. So what does this mean for that immunity deal that David Pecker and AMI have entered into with Robert Mueller?
Well, potentially nothing good. I would first say we have essentially already said to the National Enquirer, we don't think you really look a lot like a media corporation. We think you look more like a regular corporation. And that's why I think that deal actually ever came about, where they basically looked like they were just a regular corporation trying to give a thing of value, meaning to catch and kill stories, to a candidate. So we're already not sure kind of which box to put the National Enquirer in. Is it a corporation? Is it a media corporation? As to this non-prosecution agreement, I mean, the understatement of the day is, well, it's murky now, and it makes it much more difficult for prosecutors who now, I think, are under an obligation to look into whether or not there is federal criminal extortion or blackmail. And that means that it's not quite as likely that American media would continue to cooperate and give information that they might have that might be useful. So I think prosecutors, frankly, really wanted this agreement to stand up.
Mm. David, finally, what does this say about AMI and National Enquirer and their claims that they are a valid journalistic outfit?
Not so many years ago, we heard a lot of championing the National Enquirer for its work on John Edwards and questions of payments to his romantic partner outside of his marriage while he was a presidential candidate. And they were saying they deserved a Pulitzer. And I think this looks much more like the way we almost expected, except a little worse. You roll over the log and see what's underneath, as Jeff Bezos wrote. What you're seeing underneath is something very unattractive, menacing, about the exercise of power and of fear, not about journalistic inquiry to figure out what's newsworthy, but what's advantageous, cutting deals, intimidating people. You can argue that this is newsworthy, that Jeff Bezos' marriage was breaking up, but in fact, this revelation seems to have broken up his marriage, and in a way defined by spectacle, intimidation, and threat rather than a true journalistic imperative.
David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent and host of NPR's On Point. Jessica Levinson teaches law at Loyola Law School. She's our regular legal here on Press Play. Thank you both so much.
You bet.
Thank you.
Well, there may be no way movies can compete with the news these days in terms of drama. But just in case, we'll have your Friday film reviews next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday, so you know what that means. Time for movie reviews. Katie Walsh and April Wolf are here to tell us what to see this weekend. Katie reviews for the Tribune News Service and the Los Angeles Times. April co-hosts the podcast Switchblade Sisters and Who Shot Ya. Hello.
Hey.
Hello.
Let's start with Cold Pursuit, starring Liam Neeson and Laura Dern.
He died of a heroin overdose.
We didn't know our own son.
Kyle wasn't a druggie.
Sorry, but all the parents say that.
You're gonna have to say a few words.
Kyle's dead. Tell me what happened.
He got mixed up with some drug dealer.
Okay, Katie, you saw this one. Liam Neeson again playing the vengeful sad dad.
Yes, sad dad Neeson is back.
Did he ever go away?
No, he hasn't. He hasn't gone away. It's also funny that we said starring Laura Dern. She's in this movie for about 15 minutes.
She plays the wife.
The wife. Yes.
The son has been killed.
The son is also in the movie for about 2 minutes. So he is killed by some drug dealers in Denver. What's interesting about this movie is that it's a remake of a Norwegian movie from 2016 that starred Stellan Skarsgård. And the Norwegian director remade his own movie. It was called In Order of Disappearance, and now it's called Cold Pursuit. But so Hans-Peter Molland, who directed, he's remaking his own movie in English. And it takes place in a Colorado ski town called Kehoe, which I don't think is a real place. But the son gets caught up with these drug dealers and is offed by them. And so Neeson takes revenge. But the movie has got this really interesting tonal balance, which I think because the guy is remaking his own movie, he's able to achieve this Coen's Brothers-esque, like Tarantino-esque tone, which is that it is bone dry, blackly humorous, incredibly violent, but also laugh out loud funny at times. And, you know, at the heart of it is, you know, wounded Liam Neeson, who's incredibly earnest as all of these really dark, outlandish characters are sort of like swirling around him. So he gets further and further into this drug world underground. I actually think the movie's a pretty good revenge thriller, especially with the like dark, ironic tone that it has.
Well, it's interesting. It comes during the week where he's made some headlines about beating up people himself.
Yeah. So. And you know, I think he was talking about like how you get into like being in the mindset of wanting to take revenge. And obviously there are some things that should just be kept to ourselves. So,
well, and P.S., this is a pretty white movie, too.
Yeah, it is. But I will say that there is a Native American drug gang that gets involved. So,
And he can exact revenge on them?
Well, it sort of becomes this, this like son for a son for a son type of story where he's taking revenge on someone for taking his son away from him. So then the other drug dealers get a Native American drug dealer's son. And so then everybody's trying to like eye for an eye each other.
Who knew this little ski town had so many warring drug plans?
I do not want to plan a trip there.
No, yeah. I don't think so. It doesn't seem very peaceful. All right, let's move on to Under the Eiffel Tower. It's about a man who gets rejected by his best friend's daughter.
Hey, buddy.
Yeah.
I think you should come with us. 2 weeks in France. What do you think? You know how much Rosalind adores you? Plus, she wouldn't have to be stuck alone with her parents.
Can we just leave them behind and live a life of ease, just the two of us?
Would you do me the honor of being my wife?
What?
What in the hell? I'm 26 years old. You're 50?
50? April. 50's not that old.
I know.
So is this kind of, what is this? Woody Allen goes to Paris?
I mean, that's the thing, is this trailer kind of leads you to believe this movie is about something else. But in fact, that storyline is very quickly left. It focuses more on this guy played by Matt Walsh, who goes to Paris because he's lost his job. He's lost essentially like his feeling for life. And he's a guy who sells quality whiskey. You know, he's like a big rep, and like his whole life has been in whiskey, and he just gets fired and he's like, I don't know what I want to do. While he's in Paris, he hooks up with some people who are just random strangers because he's been, you know, he proposed to his friend's daughter.
And they just dump him and leave him
behind. But it ends up being a good thing. And he just kind of wanders around. He connects with these people at this winery. And it ends up being a really sweet movie where Matt Walsh gets to play a guy who kind of starts out as a loser, but he's very competent, you know, and that's just a very odd, you know, if you've seen him in Veep or you've seen him.
He plays the press secretary in Veep.
Exactly.
He's funny.
He's so funny. And he's always kind of, you know, even when he's in Upright Citizens Brigade since then, he's built a career being this like this schlub who can't do anything right. Whereas in this movie, he can do some things right. And it starts out kind of playing what you think he's going to play. And then it goes a different direction. So it's actually kind of surprisingly sweet and nice, I would say.
And then does he find an age appropriate romance?
He does find an age-appropriate romance with Judith Godrèche, who's a French star. And I'm here for the Matt Walsh leading man era. I found him really charming, and I really liked the chemistry that he had with Judith Godrèche. And I found it really charming. And the movie sort of exists in this like emerging subgenre, which is disaffected Americans like finding themselves in France and like reconnecting with their senses in a slower pace of life.
It's like Eat, Pray, Love, but with Matt Walsh and wine.
Yes, exactly.
So like a little bit of Sideways sprinkled in.
Yeah, I mean, it's
much more tame than Sideways, we'll say.
But, you know, there was this movie with Diane Lane called Paris Can Wait, which was directed by Eleanor Coppola, that's like all about like, oh, I'm having a midlife crisis and I'm going to like go on a road trip in France and like learn to love again. But I really liked it. I thought it was super charming. Like, have a glass of wine, sit back. It's like a more age appropriate, like romantic dramedy, which are few and far between.
Yeah, it's sweet.
Okay. Here is a movie that is supposedly appealing to everybody, right? The Lego Movie 2, the second part. And it's an animated movie with a star-studded cast, including Chris Pratt, Channing Tatum, Margot Robbie.
Will you help me rescue my friends?
You don't want to go anywhere near the Sistar system. It's ruled by an alien queen.
Only the toughest are going to get out of there alive.
Who's a good boy? Who's a good boy? Yeah.
Katie, you saw this one. Does it live up to the previous one? People like the previous one.
Yeah. I mean, I think the first Lego movie was so surprising. I think when it was announced, everyone was like, a movie about Legos? Like, how far are we going to go? And then, you know, it was written and directed by Phil Lord and Chris Miller. And it was so much smarter than it had any business being. And it was really funny, referential, you know, funny for adults, fun for kids. I think Lego Movie 2, will it surprise you that I think it is one of the definitive pieces of cinema of the Trump era?
Why? Because they're yellow?
That's a good one. No, because it's really about... So 2015, Lego Movie comes out. Their song is Everything is Awesome. 2019, their song is Everything's Not Awesome. And I can relate to that in a way. You know, their little town is now Apocalypseburg. They've been beset by this alien race of Duplo blocks, which are like the baby Legos, and they're very cutesy aliens that just want to play with them, and they're like fighting them off, so the aliens destroy them, and they get kidnapped to this Sistar system, and he has to go and rescue them. So it's a little bit like the Empire Strikes Back sequel. It's darker, it's more character driven, it's a big operatic space epic, but it really is about like realizing that people who want to come to our town, they come in peace, and we don't have to be defensive and we don't have to attack them. And it's like a very powerful message about xenophobia and accepting other people, even if they are different from us. So I think it's really like funny and interesting. It's not as exciting and fresh because we've seen so many of these Lego movies now. And it definitely has a little bit of a darker tone, but I thought it was really cool. I liked it.
Okay. Moving on to our final offering. This one's on Netflix. It's called High Flying Bird.
The the NBA. One, control of a game that we played better. They invented a game on top of a game.
I can see a whole infrastructure that put the control back in the hands of those behind the ball.
Okay, April, you saw this one. What's happening here? I assume they're talking about a basketball.
Yes.
Okay. Got that. So far, so good.
Okay. So directed by Steven Soderbergh, written by Terrell Alvin McCraney, who also wrote Moonlight, very famously. Mm-hmm. So the story is about this high-powered sports agent played by Andre Holland, also was in Moonlight. Mm-hmm. And he is the guy who loves the game. You know, it's not just the money. He loves the game. But he's trying to keep all of these big, big clients on the roster of his agency while there's an NBA lockout. And so that means that the players' union is not done negotiating with the owners. So within that, you know, no one's getting paid. No, you know, like everyone's waiting. Who's going to see? Who's going to budge? And Andre Holland's character is a master negotiator. And so he, as an actor, is there's some kind of intelligence in his eyes that makes you believe that he is the master who can fix all of this. It's almost like this effusive, like, hopefulness in him. And it's something that you see in Moonlight, mm-hmm. too, in the ending of Moonlight, you know, just kind of focusing on his face and this, you know, just the idea that things are going to be okay. And so I absolutely love this movie. The more that I think about it, Zazie Beetz is also in it. She plays Andre Holland's assistant, and she is kind of reprising a little bit of the character that she has in Atlanta.
She's the girlfriend.
Like, in a way, like, she's the smart one in the room who's, like, not afraid to say what no one else will say. And there's also this underlying idea about what it means to be a Black player playing for white owners. And, you know, McCraney kind of weaves this in a really artful way. And I quite liked it. You know, you have to pay attention. It's not a movie where mm-hmm. you can just put it on and kind of do something else, which let's see how it fares on Netflix. But I think that if you sit down and pay attention to it, it's really beautiful.
Okay, that sounds good. It sounds subversive.
It is.
Well, I'm pleasantly surprised that we had good movies this week because it's that time of year.
It is.
It's changing, though. I don't know what's happening. Maybe it's just distribution systems. Now that we've got streaming or something,
right.
But, you know.
There's just more competition, so yeah. They're bringing their game.
Yeah, they're trying.
We're getting out of the January doldrums a little bit.
Yeah, we're in February already.
Yeah.
All right, okay, forget what I said. All right, Katie Walsh reviews for the Tribune News Service and the Los Angeles Times. April Wolf co-hosts the podcast Switchblade Sisters and the podcast Who Shot Ya? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up, she was a transgender pioneer in the 1960s, but in 1971, soul singer Jackie Shane mysteriously dropped out of the music scene.
I think that Jackie spent the decade having a lot of fun here in gallivanting. I've asked her, Jackie, did you have a job? Doesn't seem like it.
Well, now she's nominated for a Grammy. How she was rediscovered, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're going to introduce you now to a soul singer who's been around for a long time, but I'm guessing you've never heard of her. Her name is Jackie Shane. She's nominated for a Grammy this Sunday for Best Historical Album.
Here you come again, and you say that you're my friend, but I don't know why you're. She wants to know how I feel. Tell her that I'm happy.
That is the title track from her album, Any Other Way. It is her only album. Jackie Shane was a transgender pioneer in the 1960s, but in 1971, she quit the music industry without any explanation. Well, Douglas McGowan rediscovered her just a few years ago and produced the Grammy-nominated album for Numero Group, and he's here now. Welcome.
Hi.
Well, how did you discover Jackie Shane?
Somebody mentioned her online, and I'd never heard the name before, and I just went down this rabbit hole of internet research, and I was just blown away that the music wasn't in print and that there was no way for people to find out about her.
But somehow her music was around. You could listen to it.
You could hear some songs on YouTube, but it was hundreds of plays, not hundreds of thousands.
Wow, incredible. And then when you heard the music, what did you think of it? How did it strike you?
I mean, it speaks for itself. It's just electrifying. She has so much energy. And it just became like this mission that, you know, I wanted to share this with everybody.
So you thought, okay, I got to find her. Where is she? How did you find her?
So I started to look around and there was no direct route. I found a blog post where someone was commenting and correcting the poster who stated that Jackie was dead. And he said, Jackie's not dead. I've been talking to her. And I thought, I got to find this guy. And his man in England named Jeremy Pender, who had been a fan and seen Jackie in Toronto as a teenager, was the person that led me to her.
So you found her in Nashville. And how did that go? How did you actually meet her?
I mean, so Jeremy set up a three-way call, and we spoke for about an hour. Jackie was really reluctant to speak to anybody, but he talked her into it. And by the end of the call, it felt like we were old friends. I mean, Jackie was just so resistant to being contacted, but once we got talking, she started to open up.
And in that conversation, did you convince her to make the album?
I didn't convince her of anything except that we could talk again next week. I mean, it was a 5-year process to get to this point. It was about year two when I started saying, yeah, we really should do a record.
Year two. So you were talking to her for 2 years before you suggested that, or before?
Before I started to say, well, you know, Jackie, we're not getting any younger. Let's figure out how would we do this. But everything is a process with Jackie.
And what was she like the first time you talked?
She was reluctant to speak to anyone because she didn't want to be found. She didn't want people coming to her door. There had been maybe one or two incidents where, like, fans had kind of tried to contact her, and I think she was rattled by that. So it just had to be so incredibly slow, and it was worth it.
But why do you think that she was so resistant? I mean, you're describing someone who seems like a recluse. Why had she walled herself off?
You know, I can only speculate on some level. I mean, it could not have been easy being her. It had to have been such a difficult thing to have this career, and then such a difficult emotional decision to walk away from it. And I think she just got very, very used to living a solitary life and thought, you know, why jeopardize the peace and quiet at home with her cat?
Did she tell you why she left the music industry in the early 70s?
She left because she wanted to be with her mother. I think she was exhausted. She had been in music since she was a teenager, and I think she was just tired out. It may be weird for people to hear that I have never pressed fully on questions like that, but if Jackie wanted to tell me the things that caused her to want to run away from such a successful career, she would, and she hasn't.
And how old is she now?
She's 78 years old.
78, wow. So she was transgender at a time when, you know, few people felt comfortable expressing that publicly. And she did that publicly, right, in the 1950s, 60s?
In the 60s. I mean, from what I understand, the term didn't exist until 1965. And I mean, to just for the sake of clarity, I think people have to understand that there was no way to be fully transgender at that time. It was too dangerous. But Jackie was, I would say, situationally as much of a woman as she could in any given context, and always on an edge of safety in what she did. And that's it's kind of hard for us to imagine today.
Let's hear another song from the album. This one is called Money.
Said I need money. Child, I need a whole lot of money. I said I need a whole lot of that stuff. All money. Bring it down, baby. Let me me tell these people about this money thing. You know, when I'm walking down Young Street, you won't believe this, but you know some of them funny people have the nerve to point the finger at me and grin and smile and whisper. But you know that don't worry, Jackie, because I know I look good. And every Monday morning I laugh and grin on my way to the bank because I got mine. I look good, I got money, and everything else that I need. You know what my slogan is? Baby, do what you want. Just know what you're doing. As long as you don't force your will and your way on anybody else, live
so
your life.
So there she is performing. It sounds like she's performing in a club. Where was that recorded?
I believe this was the Sapphire Tavern in Toronto. And, you know, you listen to it and it's almost like a sermon, and the theme of the sermon is liberation, whoever you are. It's just come out, whoever you are, wherever you are. And it's, you know, that's what I heard and that's what I wanted to share with everybody.
What was the audience reaction to her?
I mean, Jackie had a following. People lined up to see her, and she was the, you know, the marquee name, the number one bill in Toronto. And that's where she did most of her career, because that's where she felt most accepted and comfortable. But the only other cities that she really ever played were New York, Montreal, Boston, and Los Angeles.
And she lived in Los Angeles. She lived here for a while, didn't she?
She did. After she left her career, she actually moved to Silver Lake and lived just below Sunset Junction for about a decade.
And I guess she felt comfortable living there. There was a big gay community there at the time.
There was. And I mean, to me, on a personal level, like, that's the most fascinating chapter of Jackie's life, is what she did after she was free of the career and in a city where maybe she probably fit in better than she ever fit in anywhere.
So what did she do here?
I mean, this is the thing about Jackie, is, and nobody will believe it, that you could talk to somebody for 5 years and not find out these things. But I think that Jackie spent the decade having a lot of fun here and gallivanting. I've asked her, Jackie, did you have a job? Doesn't seem like it. You know, did you have a lot of friends? And she named off a couple of friends, and I talked to everybody I could, and when it comes right down to it, it's a bit of a mystery how she has lived all these years. And I'm personally comfortable with it, but it's kind of tantalizing.
Yeah. So what was her reaction to learning that she was nominated for a Grammy?
I mean, the word she keeps using is humbled. I mean, Jackie's, she never asked for any of this, and she'll remind everybody of that she never asked for any of it. And she's characterized it, though, as fate, that this was meant to be, and she's very, very happy about that.
Will she be at the Grammys on Sunday?
I wish. No, I invited her, but as far as I know, she hasn't left Nashville in the 21st century.
Well, best of luck to you, and best of luck to Jackie, and thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks, Madeline.
That's Douglas McGowan, West Coast head of A&R for the record label The Numero Group and owner of Yoga Records. He's a producer of the 2-disc box set Any Other Way, the first comprehensive collection of Jackie Shane's music, nominated for Best Historical Album at the Grammys this Sunday. Coming up, singer Betty LaVette is also nominated. We'll talk to her about her Bob Dylan tribute album next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. My man, oh, he's a whole lot of man. My man, he's a whole lot of man. His friends try to tell him to do wrong things. He lets them know that he's a one-woman man. My man, oh, he's a loving man. That's Betty LaVette in 1962 singing her first single, My Man, He's a Lovin' Man. She was all of 16 years old at the time. Well, she's been singing pretty much since then. Now, at the age of 73, she's nominated for a couple of Grammys this Sunday for her latest album, All Bob Dylan Covers. It's called Things Have Changed. Betty Levitt joins me now in the studio. Hi, and I saw you smiling, listening to yourself there.
Yes.
Well, there you were singing at age 16.
Yes.
Your voice has changed a little bit since then.
Thank goodness that sounded like Minnie Mouse song.
Your voice now is so, it's so lush, and it's just got this incredible amount of character to it. Tell me how you developed your singing voice.
Well, if you live to be 73, when you say, "Hi, this is Madeline," it will be, "Hi, this is Madeline."
Really? Yeah. Will I have your voice when I'm 73?
No, you know, it depends on what you do at night. And, no,
I
but
see.
My voice just, what it did was just kind of mellowed. And then as I learned to use it properly, I was able to stop losing my voice every three nights.
Mm-hmm.
And it just got more and more raspy, but it's never quite sounded like a girl. That was one of my early problems in Detroit, being 16 and not really sounding like the rest of the 16-year-olds.
So does that mean that you weren't channeled into the same kind of singing roles that young women were singing back then in the 60s? Were you seen as a different...
I was 16 and my first record was My Man, He's a Love and My Aunt. I tell the audience, I always share with, I say, let me share something with you that no one knows. I say, I wanted to be on American Bandstand so bad. I only had one little glitch. I was young. I had a cute booty, small waistline, a record in the charts. But you couldn't do the pony to it or whatever.
You couldn't do the pony to
it. Or the mashed potatoes or whatever.
Why, was it just too racy?
No, it was just not pop and youthful.
Mm.
You know, it was very, it lent itself, other than my voice, it lent itself to blues. Had I been older, it probably, like the woman who wrote it, Johnny Mae Matthews, who was possibly one of the first black female producers in the world, she sounded very much like I do now, but I was too young to be who I was.
And then you traveled around touring with bands like James Brown, for example.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like? I mean, how old were you when you were doing that?
I was a little older then. I guess this was about 1965. So I'd been singing a little while, and I had,
still a teenager.
A recording. But there are, here again, as I tell people, there are no children in show business. I don't care what you think about the Jackson 5 or the Osmond Brothers or whomever. No, 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 no. After you see a bunch of drunk people, a lot of people naked, there are no children in show business.
Did you want to be doing that at that age?
Yes, I've wanted to be grown ever since I was about two. I've been cussing and drinking since I was about two. I've always wanted to be grown, and I have no qualms with it now. I have no desire to be. I'd like to be as young as I'm having to use energy now, but I have no desire to be young again. I've never wanted to be a child.
And so the 60s and the 70s are this great explosion of rock and roll. Is that where you wanted to be, in the center of rock and roll?
No, I just wanted to be grown. My parents I was born in Muskegon, Michigan, and they came to Detroit. My whole family came from Louisiana. I was the first to be born in Michigan. My parents sold corn liquor, and there was a jukebox in our house. This was 1946, so I knew all the songs on the jukebox, and there was no rock and roll on it. It was what came out in 1946. My sister was 13, so she knew all the contemporary music. And then for blacks, if you wanted a drink after dinner or after work, you had to come to my house because you couldn't go to a bar or a restaurant. So you had to come to my house. My mother made chicken sandwiches and sold shots of corn liquor and pints and half pints. You could not come with anyone other than your wife. No one could cuss but her. And my sister's favorite artists were B.B. King, Little Esther, Little Walter, all of these people. That was what was contemporary for blacks at the time. There was no rock and roll. There was the oncoming of rhythm and blues, but there was no rock and roll.
So how did you make the transition to rock and roll, to singing these songs? Because, well, I mean, it's not traditional for a young black woman to be singing these songs.
It wasn't traditional for an 18-month-old to stand on top of a jukebox and sing the songs. I knew every song on the jukebox. So I've never categorized songs. They're just songs. I've always done, if anyone knew anything about my early career, they'd know that I had already recorded 4 or 5 Bob Dylan songs before I did this album, several by the Beatles. They were songs. And all you can do when they bring you a song is sing it the way that you sing it. I can't sound like Bob Dylan or Paul McCartney or whomever else I would, or Aretha Franklin for that matter. I can only sound like Betty LaVette, and no matter what I record, it will sound like me.
Let's hear one of the songs that you cover on this album, a famous song of his.
It's covering.
No covering.
No, interpretation.
Interpretation. Okay. Let's hear one of the songs that you interpret from Bob Dylan. This is "It Ain't Me, Babe." This is Dylan singing it.
No, 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 it ain't me, babe. It ain't me you're looking for, babe.
So that's Bob Dylan singing "It Ain't Me, Babe," and let's hear your interpretation.
You tell me you're looking for someone. Never weak, but always strong. To stand up and defend you. Whether you're right or wrong.
Talk a little bit about how you made that song your own.
I did all the songs one time because I don't like to record. It's tedious and repetitive. So this one we recorded, took it home, listened to it, and it was good. But I went back the next day and I told my producer, Steve Jordan, I asked him to put it on. I grabbed him by the arm. I said, here, skip across the control room with me. And I said, if you're telling someone to go and jump off a ledge, I don't think you should skip away. I said, in fact, the only way I would probably tell anyone to do something like that is if I was drunk. And when I said drunk, I thought Jimmy Reed, which translated into "Gone on away from my window," which is the way he would have done it.
Is that how he would have done it, with a little bit of
probably
drink
would have
in
been
him?
Even lazier than that. I actually saw this man go to sleep on stage one night. But I can only sing it the way I sing it. It's much easier for me to sound like Betty LaVette than Bob Dylan.
Well, the great thing about that is it sounds like you really know what you're talking about when you're saying, no, 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 it ain't me, babe.
Well, his lyrics lend himself to that. But as I also explained to the audience, and I've done as much in conversating with the audience while touring with this album, more than I've ever done before, because I'm surrounded by a bunch of people who've adored someone forever, who belong to either a church or a cult of his. And they say, gosh, is that what he's saying? And I said, yeah. And when you say that, it means this. He has a constant argument going, but it doesn't sound like it. And he doesn't ever want you to know that it affected him at all. It's just placid. So the songs that I did that lent themselves to hurt or anger or whatever, I employed that.
Have you met Bob Dylan?
Girl, don't you know this man? If he had said my name weeks before, it would have assured me the Grammy. He won't open his mouth. However, a year or two before this, we were in Italy on the same show. And I had gone on just before him. I came out of my dressing room. And there was all this security there. And they were like, you can't come out. And I'm like, why? Because Mr. Dylan's getting ready to go on. And I'm like, I don't give a... So I parted them and came out. I'm walking this way to go home. He's walking this way to go on the stage. And I am so angry and infuriated with them. I said, hey, Bobby, Robert Dylan. And he turned around, and his bass player was walking with him, whom I did not know. I didn't know any of them knew me. And he said, I could see him mouth, that's Betty LeVette. So he came over to me. He grabbed my face in both his hands, kissed me dead in the mouth, and walked on the stage.
No.
And that's the only sighting I've had of Mr. Zimmerman.
I love that you use his name, his real name.
Oh, you should, when I do the show, I mean, you should have seen it when I was in Minnesota, because there were people who came to see me. We bought the house he lived in, and he signed his name, Bobby Zimmerman, on the steps and just everything. So I've employed all these stories people have told me about him. And then the things I discovered about him, because that's actually what you have to do with his songs. He doesn't let on anything. Here's what happened. Didn't make me mad. Didn't make me happy. Here's what happened. But I understood from the words what he meant. He just doesn't let on how he felt about it.
But that's also part of it, the mystique, the Bob Dylan mystery. Who is this guy? What did he mean by the words? Your expression is, I'm over that.
I'm glad that it's radio.
All right, should we hear another song? Let's talk about Don't Fall Apart on Me Tonight.
You know the streets are filled with hustlers. We've lost all ray of hope. It ain't even safe no more in the palace of the Pope. Oh, don't fall apart on me tonight. I just don't think that I could handle it.
Okay, I could listen to that all day long.
Good.
That is a sexy song.
Good. I felt one thing or another about all of them. And here again, I don't know what he felt about them, but I know what he wrote. And if that's what happened, he had to have felt something about it. He just didn't share it with us.
This is the song that you're nominated for.
Yes.
For a traditional R&B performance.
And I'm a traditional R&B performer.
Will you be performing at the Grammys?
No, girl, they wouldn't let me.
What?
They said they thought that their young audience wouldn't appreciate me.
Well, I beg to differ.
Thank you. Why don't you get a group of your people and let's go and storm the joint.
Well, I'm not exactly in the young category, but I'm prepared to do that with you.
Well, no, I think that anybody would enjoy a good performance, whether it's old or young or whatever, if it's a good performance. And since all I've done for 57 years was entertain people as opposed to selling records, I felt that I could have done it.
I'm sure you could have, and I'm sure you will for many, many more years. It has been such a pleasure to have you in the studio
here. It's been so wonderful to talk to you.
Betty LeVette, her latest album is Things Have Changed. She's nominated for Best Americana Album and Best Traditional R&B Performance at the Grammys this Sunday.
Reverend woman with a worry eye. No one in front of me and nothing behind. Sitting on a strange man's lap. Drinking champagne. He's got light skin and an assassin's eye.
And that's it for us on Press Play. The show is directed by Sarah Sweeney, produced by Christian Bordahl, Amy Tal, Michelle Aloy, Yael Evan Orr, Alex Trigvedotter, Caitlin Plummer, and Milton Guevara. Mario Saavedra is our technical director. Phil Richards engineered. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great weekend. I'll see you on Monday.
I'm way out of range. I used to care, but things have changed.